morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday morning. And it's All Things Political, which you always hear Mondays at 9 o'clock. We'll mostly, I think, be talking about the sequesters across the board spending cuts that are set to go into effect on Friday. And there are lots of questions about what will happen if they do go into effect. The Secretary of Transportation, Ray Hood, has said that there could be severe disruptions of air travel, flight delays, closed towers. People could be losing their jobs. Unemployment could go up. It could cost 21.4 million jobs and add 1.5% to the unemployment rate. It would reduce military spending by $42.7 billion, non-military spending by $28.7 billion, and it would also result in a reduction in Medicare. So we have a lot to talk about this hour, and our guest is Jason Roberts, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Jason specializes in American institutions and has an emphasis on the U.S. Congress. We'll be welcoming phone calls. What would you cut? Do you think we need to cut anything? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And before we get rolling, I do want to thank you for all of you who pledged during this show and all of the programs here on Wisconsin Public Radio. That long drive is over, and I'll bet you're particularly happy if you pledged for the Waiting for Sugar Man show, which won the documentary award last night. It was very exciting. All right, Professor Jason Roberts, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What's going to happen on Friday?
Well, it's too early to tell, but we're supposed to have something called the sequester, which is a cut of about $85 billion to the federal budget for the current fiscal year. And it would be split about halfway between defense spending and what we call domestic discretionary spending.
When you look at the amount of money that's going to be cut, can we safely say that probably a lot of that money could be cut and it would be a good thing? Or will it be problematic?
Well, it's not so much the amount. $85 billion in a federal budget of $3.6 trillion is not a huge amount of money. I think the problem we may see with this is that the cuts are concentrated in very specific areas, and they avoid a lot of the more expensive parts of the federal budget.
From taxation to government programs.
For example, we're not going to see much of any cut here. But you're in military personnel will not see cuts, but you're going to see a lot of cuts to civilian people working in the defense industry and a lot of programs, federal government programs that people depend on daily.
Mm-hmm. From what I was reading over the weekend, there were indications that the president is really interested in getting a deal here and may be interested in Medicare and Social Security cuts.
Yes, I mean, if you recall the history of this, the sequester was put in place because the president and the Republican Congress could not reach an agreement on a long-term budget deal that would make perhaps some changes to Medicare, Social Security, and tax rates. And the idea behind the sequester was that the spending cuts in the sequester would be so bad and so distasteful to both parties that it would never happen.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems that both sides may have miscalculated because they have not been able to come to an agreement to this point, and it's looking increasingly likely like we're going to see the sequester occur.
Which I would imagine is going to make Americans pretty mad. We send people there to get the nation's business done, and they seem to be incapable of doing that.
I think it will upset some people. It's interesting, if you look at polling data on this, many people will tell you they think the government should be cut, and they want to see reduced spending and a smaller deficit. But when you get into the specific programs that would be cut, people are big fans of these programs. So, Americans are a little bit to blame for this. They're a bit hypocritical, and they want government spending to be cut, but they don't want to cut anything that might affect them. But I do think when you see things like longer lines at airport security or closed national parks or things such as that people will be upset.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at the whole issue of deficit reduction. There are some economists, Paul Krugman most prominently, who are saying that this isn't really the time to be focusing on spending cuts or on deficit reduction. We can deal with that a little bit later. Do you think that we do need to make this a focal point of action right now?
Well, it's not clear that it has to be done right at this moment. We do have a a bit of a problem now in that our, you know, we're spending about 18 to 20% of the gross domestic product every year, and we're only taking in about 16% in taxes. And you just can't do that in the long run repeatedly. You're going to have to at some point make your spending and your tax revenue line up more closely. The thing that Krugman and other economists who view the world more as a Keynesian point of view would say is that you cut government spending when the economy is weak, you will further damage the economy, and you should wait till the economy is stronger to cut government spending.
And when you say at some point we need to deal with it, can we define when that point is?
Well, that's very difficult to do. I mean, at this point, the lending market is telling us is there's no problem with the deficit spending we have. People are lending the U.S. government at interest rates that are effectively negative. People are paying us to take their money, so it's hard to argue that this is the exact moment when it needs to be done. However, there will come a day when interest rates may rise, and this is what people fear, is that if the government doesn't get their spending under control now, they'll have to do so with much harsher tactics in the future. I mean, the truth about these long-term changes we need to make is it is true that the longer we put them off, the more painful they will be when they finally occur.
And Professor Roberts, can you look at what the president has done, if anything, to get debt problems under control? Has he taken action?
Well, there's not a lot he can do individually. Congress alone can pass the budget, and the president has to sign off on it, but there's not much he can do individually. He has proposed a mix of some tax expenditure cuts, you know, things that we call loopholes, and some targeted spending cuts that could help the bottom line. But at this point, the congressional Republicans are opposed to further revenue increases, and they want to do this all through spending cuts. So that's the loggerheads we're at right now.
And tell me, what kinds of negotiations, if any, are taking place this week to avert substantial problems on Friday?
Well, it remains to be seen what will take place. I know the president made a phone call to congressional leaders last week. Congress was in recess last week for the President's Day holiday, and so they're back in session today. And if the path is any guide, we will see negotiations on this go right down to the wire. Both sides have seemed to really like to play this brinksmanship game where you never make a deal before the absolute last minute. So with only a few days to go, if we're a long ways off from the absolute last minute at this point.
Mm-hmm. What about the number of jobs that could be cost? Many millions?
I haven't seen an exact number on that, but it's certainly true that especially on the civilian defense side, you may see a lot of defense contractors have to lay people off if this goes through, because I think it's around $45 billion that would be all on the civilian side of the defense spending, and you will certainly see some contractors laid off.
Mm-hmm. And I was reading over the weekend that states may be facing problems because of federal money that may be coming in for military-related jobs, other kinds of jobs. This could add to states' woes, couldn't it?
It certainly could. You actually have seen over the weekend a group of Republican governors make a statement that they want Congress to deal with this. One thing the administration did over the weekend is they actually put out a press release with a list of things state by state that would be affected. And this is an effort to put pressure on members of Congress in those states to push for a kind of deal that the president would like to see.
We welcome phone calls. Our lines are busy, so let's go to them. Our number is 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political. The news, of course, this week is the across-the-board spending cuts that are set to go into effect in just 4 days. What's being done to take care of that? What could be rather substantial problem? And, of course, Professor Roberts can deal with other stories that are much in the news that you would like to discuss this hour. Professor Jason Roberts is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And we start our calls with Chris in Appleton. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I guess one thing, Kathleen, if possible, I'd like to answer a question that you asked our distinguished professor earlier with regard to when it becomes too late to make the cuts. It's commonly agreed in the economic world that it's between 80 and 90% of GDP, when that is when the debt rises to that level where we are today. And what's also widely understood is that the tipping point comes quickly, and it becomes increasingly difficult to rectify the situation we end up on a really slippery and sliding slope into something like what Greece has seen over the last several years. So I think the time to cut is now. Further, I think that the president's behavior in this whole episode has been pernicious at best. He blames Republicans for the sequester, but yet it was he and his Citigroup banker who proposed the sequestration. And he refuses to budge on anything other than just raising taxes further from what they were raised a few months or in the beginning of January. Lastly, he refers to these cuts as draconian and meat cleaver when it, for this year it's about $50 billion out of a $3.6 trillion budget, which I would hardly call meat cleaver unless someone's a lot better with a meat cleaver than I am. And also, just the percentage is so small going forward. And then the ideas that he comes up with or the threats or the scare tactics about all the things that are going to be cut is analogous to a city who has a small budget problem and refuses to cut their pet projects, but instead trumpets out cutting the firefighters and closing the library just to scare the hell out of people.
Professor Roberts.
Well, there's a lot going on there, but one of the interesting things is there has been a fight that has broken out over the weekend over who's responsible for the fact that we have a sequester, and the president has blamed congressional Republicans, and Bob Woodward over the weekend of the Washington Post penned a column and said the president had something to do with it. The truth of the matter is they both had to sign off on this. The sequester was part of the Budget Act of 2010, I believe. It was passed by majorities in both chambers of Congress and signed by the president. So the blame game is in many ways beside the point because both are at fault. And in terms of the amount, it's most people who've looked at this would say the amount of the spending cut, the $85 billion, is not so much the problem. It is how concentrated it is. It's going to devastate certain programs and leave others totally untouched. And in doing so late enough in the fiscal year that you're going to see draconian cuts in some programs, and that's where the president comes with the meat cleaver approach, while other programs will be relatively unscathed. You are seeing the scare tactics on both sides here, and the caller sort of illustrates both sides of that. People who really want the spending cuts now do point to Greece and say we're going to become Greece one day. And then, the president saying we're going to have firefighters and teachers out of work. And both of those are probabilities, but they're not likelihoods. U.S. government U.S. economy is very large and largely healthy. And we're in no risk immediately of becoming a state like Greece where people don't pay their taxes and never had. But there is a long-term spending problem that will need to be addressed at some point.
And what about increases of taxes on the wealthy that Chris talked about? What about that component of getting everything under control?
Well, at this point, the president doesn't seem to be asking for increases in top tax rates. He seems to be wanting to talk about what people call tax loopholes or tax expenditures. And these are provisions in the tax codes that allow people to not pay the full amount they would otherwise have due. And some of these are quite popular, such as the mortgage interest deduction and the deduction for charitable contributions. But others are more targeted at small things. Like there's one that gets bandied about a lot is the ability to write off the purchase of a corporate jet or something that really enrages some people. But the tax code is very complicated, and a lot could be accomplished there perhaps.
Thanks, Chris, for the call. Michael in let me get this right. Monona is next. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. I would just like to focus on the long-term challenge, and I'm hoping our government can think about long-term rather than these last-minute deals like seems to be the norm. But in the long-term, one of the things that you just can observe looking at our federal budget is our defense spending is magnitudes above any other nation on the planet. And when we have allies, and we're working together with our allies, that even makes it more silly in my mind. I think it's something like half of all the dollars or currency units spent are U.S. Currency units on military. And then when you put in our NATO allies and so forth, it becomes the vast majority on the planet. So that's an area I would focus on. It seems just way out of balance.
Professor?
The long-term challenge is there, and I think a lot of people would like to see a long-term resolution. The problem is that the incentives don't work very well for this. House members are elected in two-year terms. Senators are elected for 6 years. President Obama will be a chapter in history in less than 5 years. They don't have the incentive to work on something that we're going to see the benefits of 10 or 20 years from now because their immediate electoral or political needs are much more pressing. With respect to defense spending, the caller is correct that the U.S. spends more on defense than many other countries combined. And it's one way to think about this is, you know, we've been at war in Afghanistan and Iraq and perhaps scaling back those efforts. But something the defense industry has done very well is situate things like plants and factories that manufacture military goods and military jobs all over the country. And so you have members of Congress who are deeply invested in keeping good jobs in their districts, and many of these jobs are connected to defense spending. And so cutting defense spending is part of an international effort, but it also becomes a domestic issue when you have so many typically well-paying jobs tied up in the defense industry.
Has anybody done a really careful study, though, of how our military needs have changed with the fall of the Soviet Union, with a rise in terrorism, which is a different kind of war? I would think that we may not need as many nuclear weapons as we once did. Has that whole industry been analyzed pretty thoroughly, Professor Roberts?
There's a lot of work on this. And, you know, there are examples all the time of Congress is demanding the military buy a particular tank or a jet or something that even the military itself has said they don't need anymore because of the way that warfare has changed. But then we've seen growth in other areas, right? The drone manufacturers and the technology surrounding
yes.
that are big growth areas. So there's some of both going on there, that there is support for old technologies because they provide jobs in certain areas, but there's growth in spending in new areas that perhaps are better suited to our future needs.
We're talking this hour of all things political, which you always hear on Mondays here on the Ideas Network. Professor Jason Roberts is our guest, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, in case you'd like to leave a message there. And we also have a Facebook page. You're welcome to leave thoughts on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Monday, Jack Lee will be joining us. Jack has been just a major force in Milwaukee radio for almost 50 years. He is retiring at the age of 76, and we're going to be inviting Jack to talk about just a number of issues, the future of radio, how it has changed since he started some 50 years ago. We'll look at historical moments over his broadcasting career and how radio particularly handled those moments, how radio has been really an important source for breaking news for a number of years. Jack has also mentored many young people who would like to enter the business, and he's a wealth of wisdom. Jack will be with us hour two of our show today. All things political this hour, Jason Roberts, political science professor at the University of North Carolina, is our guest, and we're welcoming phone calls. Let's go to Ellen in Milwaukee next. Hi, Ellen.
Hello there. My largest concern is the fact that we have so many corporations that pay no taxes at all. In fact, on a program the other day, there was a graph of people, of corporations, 26 of them that paid nothing. And for some reason or other, and I don't know why, they received $350 million from the government. And I think this is a major, major problem. We're talking about changing the tax code. I think that, you know, worrying about the home interest is kind of a benign thing when we have corporations that are just not paying any money at all.
Professor?
The caller's right. Corporate taxes in the U.S. are just as complicated as personal taxes are. If you look at the rates that are on the books, we have one of the highest corporate tax rates in the world, and many corporations point out that this is a reason why we need reform. But at the same time, we do have a whole litany of tax breaks that corporations can take advantage of, and many of these corporations employ, you know, scores of accountants to make sure they can maximize these tax breaks and end up lowering their effective rate considerably. There's actually bipartisan agreement on this. Both the president and congressional Republicans have said we should both lower the overall corporate tax rate and cut out a lot of these loopholes that allow people to avoid taxation. The problem is this has been tied up in a larger taxing and spending debate and has not gotten done. But if we do get to tax reform, I do think both sides do actually agree what direction we should move on that, if not in the specifics.
You could probably easily characterize the last 4 years as one of less than complete cooperation between Congress and the executive branch. Things aren't starting off very swimmingly as the president begins another 4 years. What would it take, do you think, for things to change? Or are we going to look forward to this gridlock endlessly?
Well, if you look at the country's divided on a lot of issues. And the way that the House districts in particular are laid out, some of this is due to the way the lines are drawn, and some of it is just due to the way that people choose to live their lives. You have House Republicans with a majority, and they're representing constituencies that are much more older and wider than you have Democrats representing. And so I think it's not surprising that you're seeing some early issues in this Congress where the president and bipartisan majorities in the Senate agree on a path forward, but you're not seeing the House come along because of the small districts they represent. I think the last time I was on the show, we talked about the Violence Against Women Act, and it still hasn't moved in the House, even though it got around 80 votes in the Senate. And until we see a change in, you know, I guess you could see a big wave of new people elected to the House, we may continue to see this gridlock for a while.
Ellen, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Eric in Beaver Dam. Hi, Eric.
Hello. I was wondering, you know, what the professor's opinion is of how defense spending relates to the threat from North Korea and China. Be interested to hear what he has to say about that.
Not an expert on foreign policy, but North Korea, I think, is less of a long-term threat simply because it's a very fragile society. China is a world power, both economically and militarily, and you're seeing some consequences of that. I mean, it's fascinating to read about the cyber warfare we're involved in between us and China. You know, we've unleashed some nasty computer viruses, not so much in China, but in other places in the world, and all of the media sites and government sites that have been hacked in the last year. Turns out all those hackings are coming from one building in China that seems to be run by an arm of their military. So they certainly are a country that is going to have to be reckoned with in the future if our goals do conflict at all.
What is their goal in hacking into all of those places?
It's really not clear to me. I think it was to gain business advantages. There were some examples of companies that were considering mergers and acquisitions that were hacked and their strategy documents were found. I think military technology is always something that countries that don't have the best technology are always seeking to find. And some of the journalistic sites, the New York Times has been reporting very aggressively on some problems in the ruling party in China. They've had a lot of information about things that China doesn't like to see out there, and it's not surprising that those reporters found their emails hacked to find their sources, I think, more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Eric, thanks for the call. Diane in Milwaukee, hi.
Thank you. Since Congress is on vacation for most of the year, I think we should cut their salary and benefits in half, and because working people across the nation have taken cuts, given back benefits that they had before.
Professor Roberts.
Congressional salary is always a popular issue to talk about. And members of Congress would dispute the idea that they're on vacation. They call these recesses when they're not in Washington, I think the lingo they use is a district work period. They're in their district, they're in their states, they're meeting with constituents, they're meeting with local groups. And so they don't necessarily see this as a vacation so much as it is a different venue for getting work done. You know, the salary issue comes up a lot. Many of these people are quite wealthy before they go into Congress, so they're not doing this for the money. And if you further reduce salaries, you wouldn't make a huge dent in the federal budget, but you would make it difficult for people who are not independently wealthy to serve in Congress, which many people would find that to be an effect that they wouldn't want to have. So there's no easy answers there.
Thanks very much for your call. When you look at the Times had a piece yesterday, it was in somebody's column, of the Pew Center survey of Americans and asked them, what would you cut? Everybody thinks there's all this waste, but when you list all the areas of the federal government, people say, oh, no, I don't think we should cut that.
That's exactly right. In these polls, you always see two things pop up. One is foreign aid. Foreign aid makes up an incredibly small amount of our federal budget, but people are always in favor of cutting that, even though it would have almost no effect. I even saw a poll once that a majority of Americans believe that 5% of the federal budget was spent on National Public Radio. Which,
oh my gosh!
Was, yeah.
That's unbelievable.
In your dreams, right?
Yeah, right. Oh, what
and
we
so,
can do?
You know, yeah, right. So people have ideas of things that don't affect them that they'd like to cut. But the three biggest things we spend money on as a government are defense spending, Social Security, and Medicare. And for a lot of reasons, people don't want to cut these expensive programs. And that doesn't mean that we couldn't tinker around the edges and be more efficient in how we spend, but it wouldn't make a dent in the long-term problem necessarily.
Mm-hmm. I read that doctors who treat Medicare patients will see cuts to their reimbursement, and they're always pretty upset about that and have been vocal about that for a number of years. It seems as though these sequesters are going to make certain groups of fairly influential people in this country pretty angry.
That's right. That was how it was designed. But the idea was to make the cuts so bad that people would be forced to come to a resolution. At this point, we haven't seen that. Of course, the problem with this strategy is nothing prevents them from just postponing the sequester or ignoring it altogether. They could pass a bill tomorrow and say, you know, never mind, we're not going to deal with this. I don't think that's going to happen, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if they decide to postpone this, as they've done already. If you recall, this was supposed to happen January 1st, but they passed a two-month extension of it because they didn't want to deal with it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We may see that at the end of the week is a temporary extension of this one more time.
Mm. Our phone number, a couple lines are open now, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And you're listening to All Things Political. We have All Things Political every Monday at 9 here on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour is Professor of Political Science at the University of North Carolina, Jason Roberts. His special areas of expertise are American institutions and the U.S. Congress. Mark in Richland Center. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. I'm wanting to ask this question related to the 3 o'clock program that's coming on this afternoon with Bernie Leitner questioning the legitimacy of what we use for money. And the way that I would ask the question is, what is the economy? Because with all of the doing that people do, I would define that as our economy, and therefore the doing that needs to be done should be supplied by this thing called the money supply. Presently, we use a debt-based monetary system that cannot actually facilitate all the doing because we borrow the money into existence, and then we have to tax people to get money out of circulation. The problem with the tax side of things is that it's a disincentive on the part of people to actually participate. You see, what we've had conversation already this morning about how corporations try to get out of paying taxes in order to it's just kind of a disincentive behind it. Yet the schizophrenic nature of trying to use debt as money when the doing that needs to be done should call into existence a totally different amount of money that's in circulation. Are we not actually using the wrong kind of money? And so this afternoon, John Munson is going to talk with Bernie Leitner, who in fact helped to establish and now is against the use of the euro currency because it is a debt-based currency. So maybe that question could be asked of our leadership. Now, Dennis Kucinich introduced H.R. 2990, which would have taken away the power to issue credit or issue money as debt, but either that or Ellen Brown's State Bank of North Dakota model or some other model of money needs to be understood, because we are the economy, yet we're always hamstrung by using something that comes from virtually outside the economy to establish our capability to do what we need to do.
Professor Roberts.
Well, we do have what's called a floating currency. Now, into the 70s, we had gold-backed currency, and under the Nixon administration, we went away from that. And the Federal Reserve, in many ways, does control the supply of dollars that are available in the economy. I'm not familiar with all the things that the caller mentioned there, but if you don't have a federal currency, you do run into some problems with how we agree on what kind of trades we can make. Having a universal trading document is useful. We don't have to go back to bartering goods and services, and we can use money instead of that. But, you know, the reason we have debts and taxes is that we've decided as a society we need to provide things that people aren't going to voluntarily provide, such as roads and bridges and national defense, and that leads to currency and debt, which is how we get into these discussions.
Do you ever stop and think, I think about this about every 6 months, maybe more often sometimes, how strange the whole money thing is, that you have to make money. You know, you got to go to work. Governments need money. We all need money, that we don't just barter, that we didn't come up with some kind of completely different system for our time on this earth.
Well, you could go back to bartering. I mean, people do that on a small scale now, but it'd be difficult. I mean, we think about transporting items, or you know, what if your specialty are things that are highly perishable,
right?
You can't sell it all. You can't trade it all at one time. So money does reduce a lot of transactions costs in society.
Thanks, Mark, for your call. Joan in Milwaukee. Hi, Joan.
Hi. There are some military jets that I hear have run into engine problems now. So their development or their production or whatever is set on the side. But they're running 70% over the estimate that they made. Why can't they just be scrapped and recycled? You know?
I think the call is,
like,
oh, I'm sorry,
why are we throwing something down the rat hole?
I think the caller is talking about something that used to be known as the Joint Strike Fighter, or the F-35, I believe it is. And this is an airplane designed to serve the Air Force, the Army, and the Navy. And it was competitively bid out. I believe McConnell Douglas won the bid, and then they were forced by Congress to then share some of the work with Boeing. And is spread out all over the country, and as these projects develop, you see different branches of the military start requesting different capacity for the aircraft, and it's very common for the cost to spiral out of control on these things. And I think the specific thing she's mentioning is there was a problem with an engine on one of the planes the other day, so they've grounded the entire fleet at this point until they figure out what caused the engine trouble. But these things do run over budget, but jobs are tied to them is why we don't scrap the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it is supposed to be a very good plane if it's ever manufactured at the rate that they're hoping to be able to do so.
Thanks, Joan, for your call. Our lines are open if you'd like to join our All Things Political conversation. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And speaking of travel, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood added to the consternation about what could happen on Friday when he talked about severe disruptions of air travel, flight delays, towers could be closed. I think people who fly are more than a little nervous about that.
Absolutely. The idea is that if you see this question going into effect, you could see fewer transportation security agents working at security, which would increase the line length to get into the airport, which I'm sure everyone will enjoy.
Right.
And then if you don't have air traffic controllers telling us when we can take off and land, you can't do that. When anyone wants to risk any sort of mid-air collision. That would be catastrophic. And so it could seriously disrupt air travel. Now, what's unclear is how this could be managed, and it's in the interest of people who want this money to make it sound worse than perhaps it will be. But there's no doubt about it. You can't reduce the number of security agents and air traffic controllers without affecting air travel.
And so could there be any exceptions made? Tomorrow, could Congress say, well, we're going to have a sequestration, but there are some services that are absolutely vital to keeping the country going and for the safety of all concerned. We simply won't be able to cut money if it will result in disruptions of air travel and safety concerns. Could they do that or not?
They could do that. There is a small group who wants to roll this into the rest of the budget for the year and spread the cuts out a little more evenly and give agencies a little more discretion as to where those cuts fall. Again, this was designed to make things miserable for people, so it's not as if people designed these cuts to not disrupt people's lives. That was the whole idea behind it. So sure, they could certainly decide not to do that. And it may be advantageous for the congressional Republicans to cut a deal early, because we've seen in the past in these kinds of crises that the president has the ability to speak with one voice, has the bully pulpit, can command the attention of the American public. And, you know, when they show lines on the news of people standing in line forever to get on an airplane, or you see firefighters out of work, and the president can say, I'm blaming congressional Republicans for this, it's going to turn public opinion against them. So it will probably be in their interest to try to find a solution before Friday, but it's unclear that they will.
More phone calls in a moment. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number. Email, we haven't had any of those today, but you can use that if you'd like. That's talk@wpr.org. Hour two of our program today, we'll talk about radio. And there is so much to talk about when you talk about radio, isn't there? We'll look at the history of radio. Our guest, Jack Lee, who is retiring at the age of 76. He's been actively involved in Milwaukee radio for some 48 years, witnessing the conversion from radio to TV, AM to FM, music to talk formats, broadcast to digital. What is the future of this medium? We'll talk about great moments in history, great voices on the radio, and that will be with Jack at 10 o'clock. Okay, to Neil in Pine River. Hi, Neil.
Hi there. How are you?
All right. How are you?
Good.
Good.
My question was, I work for an energy company all over the country, energy savings company, and we work for a lot of different companies in the energy savings. I work for quite a few HUD projects, low-income housing projects, and I've seen both good and bad. I guess my question is, you know, sometimes when we go out on these jobs and we actually acquire a contract with them, we're required to hire a percentage of the people in the developments or in the projects that we're working in. First of all, I would say more than 80% of them can't pass the drug and alcohol test to be employed, and the ones that we do get employed will sometimes we'll have multiple month projects, sometimes up to 6 month projects, and the people that do get hired will work for us for a couple of months, maybe great workers a lot of the time, and then they just disappear. Their reason for quitting is that they're going to get kicked out of their housing because they're making too much income. And I see that kind of abuse. I see the abuse and the filth and just atrocious situations in some of these projects and some projects have, you know, some of the houses and apartments and stuff, the people have nicer furniture, nicer TVs, nicer appliances than I have as a working person, but they're, you know, basically low income, underemployed. Some of them may be in a situation of elderly, you know. I just was wondering, you know, how much of the budget is federal and state funded for those type of projects, and, you know, what can be done to police that a little better?
I don't know the exact percentage of the budget that goes to housing and urban development, but, you know, it's certainly not on the scale of something like Social Security or Medicare. But, you know, the caller is right. You can't perfectly design a social welfare system that does not create incentives for certain people to try to game the system. And, you know, we see this in all aspects of the government. People try to game the Medicare system to get their maximum amount of money they can out of it. There was a great story in Time magazine last week that discussed how medical device makers are able to charge inordinate amounts of money for their devices we get implanted into us. And there are some perverse incentives in the unemployment situation where people can't take part-time jobs because it'll put them over the income limit to get their unemployment benefits, and so they're better off continuing on the unemployment benefits. We certainly could make those programs work a little better, but there's no perfect way to implement any of these kinds of programs.
Well, let's look at the two programs that you mentioned earlier that are the huge big-ticket items, and they are Social Security and Medicare. If we're going to look at deficit reduction seriously, don't you simply have to look at those programs?
Absolutely. There's no way to solve a long-term budget issue in the country without dealing with Social Security and Medicare. And of those two, Social Security is probably the easier one to deal with. Its long-run deficit is not nearly as immense as the Medicare long-run deficit, but it still needs some adjustments. There has been some good news on Medicare. The growth rate of Medicare has come down a little bit in the last couple of years. The projections have the news on the exact spending has not been as bad as the projections were. But we still are entering into a point in the nation's history where we have an aging population. We're going to have a lot of people on Social Security and Medicare and many fewer people who are of working age. And, at any point, societies have to deal with a problem like this. It does really hinder economic growth, and it puts a lot of pressure on the federal budget. I mean, these things eventually work themselves out. The fact that we have not as many people working now means that when those people are retiring, there'll be fewer retirees. But the next 20 or 30 years are going to be incredibly difficult as this baby boom population enters into retirement. And we're going to have to make some changes in programs and probably on the tax side to make that economically sustainable.
The thing that I don't understand, Professor Roberts, is that generation was born, 60, 65 years ago. We've had a lot of years to figure out how to change the system to deal with that huge population, and we just don't do it.
That's true. I mean, you can almost, I tell my students sometimes they should blame that generation because this is the generation that insisted that their taxes be lowered and they not have to pay more taxes, and now they're going to sit on the other side of it and collect those benefits. Up until the last couple of elections, though, young people didn't vote at very high rates, and so it's the 40 to 60 year olds who tend to vote, and they have people who protect their interests, such as the AARP is one of the best funded and largest interest groups in America, and they make it clear they don't want to see changes to these programs. So, we got what we asked for in some ways, but it's going to be unpleasant in how it falls on younger generations.
Neil, thanks for your call. Bill in Madison, hi.
Hello. A lot of good points have been made, but the point that no one seems to make is that America's debt to GDP ratio is only about 106%, which compared to Germany, many people consider to be a bastion of good government and good management, is running well over 200%. Taking on the costs of reunification of East and West Germany, for example. I think the problem is the erosion of real income of the bottom 99% over the last 40 years is why we have such a shortfall in terms of government revenue to pay for the programs that we have. And no one seems to mention that. And all this talk about the deficit and the debt, again, our debt to GDP ratio, which I think is the most important measure, is not that bad.
Professor Roberts.
Yeah, the caller is right. Our debt to GDP is certainly not as bad as other countries in the world at this point. The concern that people have is that with this demographic boom I just spoke about, that this could get worse over time. And that we could get to a point in 20 years where this is no longer sustainable, and thus it's important to do something about it now because it gets more expensive as time goes on. The caller also brings up another point. We have had fairly stagnant incomes in the bottom 99% of the income distribution Now, thankfully for those of us who live in that income distribution, the inflation has been very low over the past 10 years. And so the productivity of the economic market and the flattening of society through globalization has made goods and services cheaper to buy over time, but salaries also have flattened out, or if not gone down. And so it would certainly help a lot of our problems if we had economic growth pick up, and it would lead to salary increases in the lower ends of the income distribution. That would solve a lot of our debt to GDP problems, and it would make people living in those income distributions happier with their lot in life, I believe.
Thanks, Bill. Larry in Menominee. Hi.
Yes, I get a kick out of people in the press. First off, in the mainstream media, unemployment goes up, our economy shrinks, and we get reports that we have steady job growth. It's unbelievable. And also, $16 trillion in debt. How can that not be too bad? And third, the president comes up with the sequester. Instead of dealing with it, we're busy going back and forth playing the blame game. When is this president going to owe up responsibility that obviously he cannot run the economy? 5 years, we've heard nothing but we're going to help the middle class and all this. Well, my taxes went up, and I'm middle class. So, I'm still waiting for this economic growth coming to restable the economy.
Professor Roberts.
The caller makes a good point there. It is confusing sometimes to look at these numbers and see steady job growth, but yet not a big change in the top line unemployment rate. That's because it takes about, I think, 160 to 190,000 jobs per month just to keep up with population growth in the country. This may get better over time. One upside of the demographic boom we were talking about is we are starting to see the front edge of that baby boom generation retire, and workforce participation will go down, which will make it easier for younger people to find jobs. In terms of who's responsible for the economy, I think the presidents often get too much blame and too much credit. They get too much blame when things are going poorly, and they get too much credit when things are going well. The bottom line is that all of these taxing and spending policies are set by Congress has to move first. The president has almost no ability to independently influence economic growth. He depends on Congress to work with him to do that. And as we've been talking about for most of the show, Congress and the president have disagreed repeatedly over what should be done or should not be done. So to the extent we're going to give out credit and blame, we need to blame both sides are clearly at fault here.
And Bob, our final caller in Bear Creek. Hi, Bob.
Yes, hello. I just want to ask about the farm bill, which was temporarily extended. We don't seem to get a handle on farm spending. We've got ethanol now. We can't buy gasoline without ethanol in it. We have taxpayer-funded insurance policies for crop failure and the sort. And I'm just wondering how we're going to uncouple some of this. We had the Freedom to Farm Act back in the 90s drafted by then a conservative Republican, Richard Lugar, and I don't see how we can resolve even the farm bill. I would sure like to see us move forward with it, and I'll just take my comments off the air.
Thanks, Bob.
Now, the farm bill is incredibly complicated. As the caller points out, we've had a great deal of trouble getting a new farm bill enacted. There are a lot of disagreements. The House Republicans are fairly opposed to a lot of the farm subsidies we see now. But you do have senators from these small states. They have a bit of an advantage in the Senate, given they're, these small states get two senators, as does California, and so they're very protective of these farm interests. But I do think in any new budget deal, there is some bipartisan consensus to reduce the amount of subsidies we provide to the farming and maybe expand crop insurance would be the way to manage that issue.
And thank you very much for all of your calls, everybody. Professor Roberts, thank you. It doesn't look likely that anything's going to budge this week, though, so who knows what will happen Friday.
Hopefully we'll be wrong. It was my pleasure being on the air.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to have you with us. Our guest this hour, Professor Jason Roberts. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Specializes in American institutions with an emphasis on the U.S. Congress. In all things political, in case you're just tuning us in for the very first time, which is hard to believe, but welcome. We have All Things Political every Monday at 9 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program and to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up momentarily, and then we're talking about radio, the history and the future. Stay with us.